The question of how we should act when facing something gravely immoral is a difficult one. This is particularly true when that immorality touches upon our everyday life. Such was the issue that Quakers and others faced with the question of goods produced by slaves. Was consuming goods, such as sugar or cotton clothing manufactured by slaves, incompatible with abolitionism? Could the refusal to consume such goods contribute to the liberation of slaves? In her new book, Moral Commerce, Quakers and the Transatlantic Boycott of the Slave Labor Economy, published by Cornell University Press in 2016, Dr. Julie Holcomb focuses on abolitionists who answered yes to both of these questions. In this carefully researched and fascinating study, Holcomb examines the boycott movement in the Atlantic world, focusing on Britain and the United States, and ties together various discourses on race, religion, culture, and the economy. This book is particularly well-suited for those interested in the history of abolitionism, but because of the wide variety of subjects it covers, virtually every reader can find something useful in it. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies. I'm Dr. Franklin Rausch of Lander University, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Julie Holcomb about her new book, Moral Commerce, Quakers and the Transatlantic Boycott of the Slave Labor Economy. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Oh, well, we're glad to have you. Well, to start, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I grew up in a small logging town in southern Oregon. I'm a fourth-generation Oregonian, actually. I was the first in my immediate family to go to college. And as I remind my students, it took me 3 attempts to complete my undergraduate degree. So I always tell them, you know, persistence is an important characteristic. But life kept intervening for me. But finally, when I was in my 30s, my family moved to Portland, and I had a chance to go back to school for the third time. So after completing 2 years at Portland Community College, I transferred to Pacific University, which is a private liberal arts college in Forest Grove, which is a suburb of Portland. And so I had to find this major. History wasn't on my radar at that point, and I was really struggling with identifying a major. I was drawn to creative writing and literature. But this voice in my head kept saying, well, that's not very practical, and, you know, you have a family and you need to be practical in terms of careers. So prior to returning to college, I had worked in public and school libraries and really loved working with books and working with patrons. And I thought, well, maybe I could combine those interests, that interest in libraries with my academic interest. And about this time, I'd really started to develop an interest in history. I'd taken an American history course with the professor there, the American history professor at Pacific, Larry Lippin, and I really enjoyed the class. It was not what I had experienced in high school. I didn't have the best teacher in high school. And completed that course and decided to add the history major. And so I decided that, as I'm trying to figure out, what am I going to do, after I graduate, I do have to figure out something here. I talked to Larry and about my interest in combining maybe history and librarianship. That seemed like a possibility working in academic libraries. And he suggested archives as a possible career path. And I thought, I had only a vague notion of what an archivist did. So he sent me over to talk to the library director, who then put me to work in the university archives. And it was like this perfect match of I could do history, but in a very, pragmatic way. I got to work in the archives there for 2 years. Pacific was an ideal location for a budding archivist. If you're not familiar with the university, it's the oldest chartered university in the West. It was granted its original charter as the Tualatin Academy in 1849. And it actually began as a school in a log cabin to educate the orphans, care for and educate the orphans of the Oregon Trail. So it has a very long and very rich history. And so I spent, as I said, I spent 2 years working in the archives. And when I graduated from Pacific, my plan was to go on to graduate school, get a master's in library science with an emphasis in archives, and then go on for doctoral work in history. So my long range goal with that was I wanted to work in a labor archives. I had studied with Larry Lippin. He was a labor historian. I had developed a deep interest in labor history. I wrote my senior thesis at Pacific about labor conditions in the timber industry during World War I. So I was very, interested in this idea of labor history and particularly working as an archivist within a labor history collection. Headed off to UT Austin while I was working on my master's degree there in library science. Life intervened again. I had an opportunity to take a position as a college archivist for a new Civil War collection that had been donated to a college here in Texas. And I decided to take that position. It was just too good an opportunity to pass up. And so I took that position, took a break from school after finishing my master's, but never really gave up that idea of going back for the doctorate, and decided to, instead of pursuing the doctoral degree in history at UT Austin, ended up enrolling at UT Arlington because I could go to school part-time and continue to work at the museum. And so I worked at the museum, with the Civil War collection, which became a museum. I worked there for 8 years before I ended up at teaching at Baylor.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Well, that's quite an interesting, what can I say, scholarly pedigree. You've been done a lot of different things. So could you tell us then, because it's kind of then a shift, right? Because your focus was on public history and archives. And then you wrote a book about Quakers and abolitionism and capitalism and all these things mixed together. So can you tell us, how did you come to write Moral Commerce?
Well, it started back as an undergraduate student at Pacific University. That's where I first learned about the boycott while I was writing an undergraduate paper about Florence Kelly, the progressive era labor reformer. And in the biography of Florence Kelly, I found out that her aunt, Sarah Pugh, was an abolitionist. And she was an abolitionist who abstained or boycotted slave-grown sugar and cotton and did for years and years. She was active in the movement. And I kind of made a mental note of that and thought, that's kind of interesting. I've never heard of that. But I was, again, my focus was really on labor history, and so I kind of moved on from that. Well, then several years later, when I was working on my doctorate, I came across the movement again, this time in Betty Friedland's Men and Brothers, which is about the Anglo-American abolitionist movement and the connections between the two movements. And I thought, well, that's interesting. That's the second time I've come across that. I didn't realize that there was a British component to the movement. And so it really came out of Moral Commerce, came out of just my curiosity about this international consumer movement against slavery. Why were there so few references to it? Why could I not find a book about it? I really wanted to know more. I wondered why so little had been written about the movement. And so it really came out of this sort of my curiosity, because I thought, wow, this is a really audacious idea that somehow, consumers, by changing their habits of consumption, could somehow bring about the end of slavery.
Oh, excellent. And so, that segues perfectly into your introduction to your book. Could you tell us a little bit about what was it, the boycott movement? I hadn't really thought about it before I read your book. What is it?
Well, let me start with, maybe I should start with a little bit of a definition, and that is, talking about, because I use the word boycott, but I use that word sort of consciously, knowing that that's actually sort of an inaccurate label, I guess, if you will, for the movement, because boycott is actually a late 19th century word. It's a late 19th century term that actually referred to the anti-colonial protest of Irish peasants against the British landlords. It's actually, the word boycott is derived from the name of the British land agent, Captain Charles Boycott. But it's in our modern language, it's come to mean this, sort of abstaining or rejecting particular goods or particular services. And I use that word in my title because it's one that I think more modern readers are more familiar with than, say, free produce. friend of mine used to tease me about, you know, when I'd say free produce, she said, well, it sounds like you're liberating broccoli. And she said, and I know that's not what you mean. So I use the word boycott, but in this sense, boycott is referring to really two distinct movements that form this larger boycott of slave labor goods. Initially, the boycott movement focused on abstaining from the products of slave labor. This was in the 18th century, and it really originated with a small group of Quakers, including John Woolman, this New Jersey Quaker minister, who believed that, you know, any benefit from slavery, if you benefited in any way, whether from the products of slave labor or whether the services of slaves, that you were somehow contributing to the continued oppression of Africans, that it wasn't enough to be anti-slavery or to free your slaves, but that you had to refuse to benefit in any way from slave labor. And that idea remains the heart of the movement, really, even into the 19th century. But what we see in the 19th century is that there's a shift in the movement, and that with the rise of the market, the shift really focuses to substitution, that is, substituting free labor goods for those produced by slave labor. So abstention still remains a part of that movement, but more and more activists are really trying to replace slave labor goods with those made by free labor. And so what I'm looking at is like these two movements and how that relates to the anti-slavery movement.
Right. So you mentioned your book that there's been some work on the boycott movement before. Could you tell us, how does your book deepen and add to our understanding of this movement?
Sure. Yeah. And as you noted, there are some other works out there. Ruth Nurnberger wrote a book on the American free produce movement in 1942, a short book. And then there's been some work done on other aspects of the boycott, and both in the United States and in Britain. But really, my book contributes to our understanding of the boycott in really three key ways. Moral Commerce is the first book to examine the breadth of the slave labor movement. So we have works that look at, say, the 18th century British sugar boycott, or articles looking at that. We have studies that will look at like discrete moments, but mine is the first that really looks at the movement, at the full history of the movement. So I begin in the late 17th century and go through the American Civil War. And so looking at this movement over more than 100 years of activism gives me an opportunity to look at how different groups of activists interpreted the boycott. And this leads to some really interesting comparisons. For example, we can see how women's activism changed between the 18th and 19th centuries, that it's very different. We can see also in the impact that Black abolitionists have on the movement as well, and how that movement shifts over this period of time. So my book is, Moral Commerce is the first to really examine the breadth of the boycott.
Excellent. So can you tell us then, you know, there's this interesting kind of connection, because the book's title is Moral Commerce, and in the subtitle it talks about Quakers. So how do Quakers get to be a part of this story? Why do some of them come to oppose slavery? And why do those people come to think that the boycott movement would be a good way to do so?
Okay. Actually, could we go back to the previous question for just a moment?
Sure.
Because I realized that I didn't finish out my thought there. I said three ways and I only mentioned one.
Oh, sure. No problem. We'll go back.
Okay. So anyway, so my Moral Commerce is the first to examine the full history of the boycott. It's also, I think Moral Commerce is really in doing that, and the way that it helps to improve our understanding of the boycott. Really looking at it over that 100-year period, it really emphasizes how the boycott idea has this very long history. We tend to focus on, you know, historians of abolitionism tend to focus on, you know, questions about colonization, gradualism, immediatism, these different approaches to the abolition of slavery. And actually, before we even had those conversations, Quakers were introducing this idea of boycotting slave labor goods. also, and then finally, in answering that question about how it contributes to the understanding of the boycott, I think moral commerce is really an, this is coming out at an important time. We're having a lot of conversations about the connections between capitalism and abolitionism, and moral commerce makes it interjects that the consumer into those conversations about the relationship between slavery and capitalism.
Oh, excellent. So yeah, you're making these connections that haven't and looking at things more deeply. So I think that's one thing that makes this a very interesting study.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Because it really emphasizes, Ed Baptist had a book that came out a couple of years ago, The Half That Has Never Been Told. And he really emphasizes the economic strength of the slave labor economy. And you take his book and you read that alongside, say, my book. And it really, I think it really helps to underscore just how audacious that experiment was of trying to replace slave labor, say slave-grown cotton with free labor cotton, they really were up against some pretty formidable obstacles in making that happen.
And so why, as you just said, that there's these formidable obstacles, so why did some Quakers think that this would be a good way to stop slavery?
Well, it really comes out of it's deeply rooted in Quaker anti-slavery. In the late 17th century, you know, Quakers are beginning, there are a few individual Quakers who are coming out in opposition, or they're beginning to question the legitimacy of slavery. And you continue to hear these individual voices into the early 18th century. And again, some of it, you know, it's coming out of Quaker religious beliefs about the light of Christ within, that everyone, whether, you know, regardless of their familiarity with Christianity, every individual has the light of Christ within. It's ideas about the golden rule, as well as Quaker ideas about pacifism. All of these ideas are incompatible with slaveholding. And so you have these individual voices who are starting to, you know, speak out and speak out against slaveholding, but they're very much in the minority in the late 17th century, early 18th century, and it's not until mid 18th century that we really start to see Quakers as a corporate body, that is the Quakers as a group coming out in opposition of slavery. And a lot of it has to do with of course, we have the Seven Years' War in this period. There are a lot of political crises, religious crises going on, you know, things happening in this period that Quakers are really starting to question, you know, their support of slaveholding. What connection is it having with these other events? Is it, you know, they're seeing their connection to slaveholding as perhaps evidence of their falling away from the faith, of that they've lost their way. And so, you know, they're coming out in opposition of slaveholding, and they're this small group, John Woolman, Joshua Evans, Anthony Benezet, some others, who are coming out and saying, it's not just enough. It's not enough to reject slavery and slaveholding and slave trading. We need to reject all benefits of slavery, and that includes the goods and services produced by slaves. And it comes out of this sort of this notion, the prophet Isaiah, you know, he exhorts the faithful to walk righteously, to speak honestly, and to reject the gain of oppression. So for Quakers like Woolman, you know, if you benefit in any way from slave labor, you're benefiting from the gain of oppression. So it's part of this, it's taking anti-slavery and taking it as thoroughly anti-slavery as you can be. But one of the interesting things about Quaker anti-slavery in this period and Quaker boycotting in this period is that it's as much an anti-consumer movement as an anti-slavery movement, because Woolman and others like him are calling on Quakers to not only reject slave labor goods, but to reject luxury goods as well. So it's as much anti-consumer as it is anti-slavery.
Yeah, and that was one thing that really struck me that I hadn't thought about, I just tended to think of abolitionists as just being, well, they're anti-slavery, but you showed how there was this kind of Quaker critique, not only of slavery as wrong for slaves, but as something that hurt other people as well. And there were this kind of economic critique as well and cultural critique. Could you tell us a little bit more about how those come into the picture?
Sure. Well, Woolman, I think, is probably the most exemplary of that, he wrote a lot of essays about that. His A Plea for the Poor, for example, he talks about what he recognizes that, you know, individuals will have varying degrees of success in business, or in, you know, that some will be more wealthy than others, but he sees within that if you have been more successful, if you have more money, that you have a responsibility to others, and that if you if you cause others to labor excessively on your behalf, if you're you're laying this burden on these other individuals, and that there should be he and Benazé, for example, both really praise the African subsistence economy as exemplary of sort of this is the ideal, that there's enough for all to, you know, to benefit, to enough for all to live.
Excellent. So you talk about then in chapter two how some of this is going to get organized, right? And you're going to have this 18th century British abstention campaign that's going to be successful. So could you tell us a little bit what this campaign was and why it was so successful?
Sure. So this idea that, you know, the Quakers had been putting forth about abstaining from slave labor goods, this sort of anti-consumer, anti-slavery movement. Woolman travels to England, and that idea, you know, it's transferred from America to England along Quaker lines of communication, and it's talked about, and it gets caught up there as the abolitionist movement begins to take off in the 1780s. It gets caught up in that idea, and there starts to, in the late 1780s, there's some discussion about boycotting slave-grown sugar as a form of anti-slavery protest. And it's interesting because this is happening at the same time that there's a lot of concern about habits of consumption, and especially women's habits of consumption. And you see in the popular culture in this period, you see a lot of poetry, but there's also a lot of political commentary too about how much money women are spending on the new habit of tea consumption. And of course, what do you have with tea? You have sugar. And so there's a lot of critique in this period about women's, how much money women are spending on tea equipment, how much money they're spending on tea and on sugar. And so you have that discussion going on sort of at the same time as the abolitionist movement taking off. So in 1791, after an extensive debate in Parliament about the abolishing the slave trade, the abolition bill fails. And this Baptist printer, which is interesting, it's a Baptist printer, not a Quaker printer, who writes a small tract called calling on consumers to boycott slave-grown sugar as a way of protesting Parliament's failure to abolish the slave trade. And that little tract sets off this enormous boycott. We don't have accurate figures, but some estimates place the number of boycotters in 1791, 1792 as high as 500,000, which is a pretty amazing number when you think about it. And over this period of time, there's this 1791, 1792, there's this very rich print culture that sort of develops all these tracts, both in favor of slave-grown sugar and opposing slave-grown sugar are published. There's a, you know, really a war of words going on over the consumption of sugar. And a lot of that gets tied into these debates about women and their consumption of sugar-sweetened tea. And it's really interesting because it's, you know, women are accused of, you know, sweetening their tea with blood-stained sugar. You see lots of references to the flesh and blood of slaves and sugar bowls on ladies' tea tables, and it becomes this sort of, you know, it's very much about how much, you know, how disgusting the rhetoric can be. You know, we have tales of slaves being boiled to death in pots of sugar cane juice, for example. But it gets caught up, and all of this gets caught up in the boycott, and I think that all contributes to the success of the boycott, because the boycott is drawing support from people who are not just anti-slavery, but it's also drawing support from people who are anti-consumer or anti-women's consumption. And for women who participate in the boycott becomes a way of demonstrating, I guess, their morality or their ability to forego luxury goods on behalf of the slave, that they can be these moral consumers.
And that makes a lot of sense, right? Because wasn't there this idea that women as kind of guardians of the home were more moral at this time?
It's starting to develop in this period, but there's still this sort of this question. And, you know, I talk about women as unreliable abolitionists because there's sort of this notion that, well, you know, there's some concern. There are some of the writers in this period are saying, well, women are so, you know, enamored with their sugar sweetened tea and with their goods and, you know, with the goods of the tea table, and, you know, the tea ritual is so important to them that will they really give up their consumption of sugar, slave grown sugar and tea? Will they actually do that on behalf of the slave? And so it becomes, so there's still a question. Now, by the 1820s, that question's not even, that doesn't even come up. But in the 1790s, there's still just enough of a question. We're really on the sort of that transition to where we begin to see women as the center of the home.
So you discussed a moment ago how this was very successful. An estimate of maybe 500,000 people participate in this. And so in chapter 3, you examine how Americans tried to also carry out such a boycott. But it wasn't as successful. So what happened with the American boycott?
Well, part of the failure of the American boycott really had to do with the failure, you know, the compromises of 1787 and the failure of any kind of an anti-slavery movement to really take off in the U.S. the way it did in Britain. So that was a significant aspect of it, because in Britain, supporters of the boycott could really tap into the energy of the anti-slavery movement, of the abolitionist movement. We didn't have in the U.S. that kind of a movement wasn't present. And it really, the support for the boycott in the United States really remained with Quakers. It didn't, in Britain, it became very much an ecumenical movement. It was no longer just a Quaker movement. The Quakers, one historian talks about how Quakers staged this disappearing act, and that's certainly the case in Britain, that Quakers were, you know, really helped to get that movement going, and they were very much involved in getting that movement going and keeping that movement going. But if you look at the rhetoric, say, of the British slave sugar boycott, it's not Quaker rhetoric. It's very ecumenical in focus. And that's not the case in the United States. In the United States, the core of support for the boycott remains with Quakers. And in this period of time, with the rise of evangelicalism, the development of that, there are a lot of changes going on among Quakers, and in terms of they're being influenced by this evangelical movement. A lot of dissension among Quakers in this period, and so they're sort of distracted by all of these religious disputes, which is having an impact on the boycott. The boycott also gets caught up in that, because you have two different factions that essentially develop in the early 19th century. You have the Hicksites, that is those who were supportive of the teachings of the Quaker minister Elias Hicks, who was a supporter of free produce. And then you have another group, Orthodox Quakers, who were really sort of engaging with mainstream evangelical ideas. And so these two groups, as they're forming, Free Produce is supported by both. There's support for Free Produce on both sides of that debate, but it really becomes almost a weapon in the fight between Quakers and this internal dispute. And so that sort of, that really reinforces the idea that in many people's minds, it reinforces the idea that, that Free Produce or the boycott, abstention from slave labor goods, that this is really just a Quaker movement, and that it really doesn't have any relationship to any kind of or doesn't have much importance to the anti-slavery movement. And so that really sort of, the lack of a, of an abolitionist movement plus what's going on with the Quakers sort of limits any kind of growth of the Free Produce movement and, or the boycott in this time period in the United States.
And one other thing I found very interesting about this chapter was your section on Black abolitionists. Could you tell us how do they fit into this whole abstention campaign?
Sure. And this was something that I struggled with a bit was, you know, how do Black abolitionists fit into the abstention campaign? Because, religion, gender, and race were really the three themes that I was trying to work with in this book. And, I kept hoping I would find something, evidence of Black abolitionists, organizing boycotts or something. But what I found instead is that as slaves are, as Blacks are being freed in the North, as slavery is being abolished in the Northern states, and Blacks are starting to form their own communities, and they're sort of developing their own communities, developing their own organizations, that this is really the beginning of what we would see later in the Free Produce movement with a lot of activism on the part of Black abolitionists in support of the boycott of slave labor. So you have, these different organizations that they form, insurance organizations, self-help groups, that all really begin to form the basis of a community of support for the idea of free produce. And they're linking this idea of free produce or the boycott of slave labor to ideas of racial equality, that if free Blacks have access to, that is, that if they can benefit from their labor, that is, that they get to enjoy the fruits of their labor, that that becomes the basis of the basis of racial equality, that can be a foundation for that.
Excellent. So in the next chapter, in chapter 4, you move back to England and the second British abstention campaign. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that campaign and especially the role of women like Elizabeth Hayrick, the role they played in it.
Sure. So we have a second, as you mentioned, there's a second campaign in the 1820s in Britain. This is the second major boycott of primarily slave-grown sugar, and it, like the first British boycott, is quite successful. Again, we do not have accurate numbers as far as participation, but I know the historian Claire Midgley, she estimates, the British historian Claire Midgley estimates that probably numbers were even of participation were even higher than those in the 1790s. And it really begins with, it begins with Elizabeth Hayrick, who wrote a tract in 1824 called Immediate, Not Gradual Abolition, or An Inquiry into the Shortest, Safest, and Most Effectual Means of Getting Rid of West Indian Slavery. And in this tract, Hayrick connects the immediate abolition of slavery to the boycott. So if we boycott slave labor goods, that will bring about the immediate abolition of slavery. Hayrick is an interesting individual because she comes out of a Unitarian Quaker background. Her father was a hosiery manufacturer. She's had a very interesting life. She had an unhappy marriage. And I kind of question whether she might have participated in the first sugar boycott in the 1790s. She was a new bride at that time, newlywed in the 1790s, so it's entirely possible that she participated in that earlier boycott. But she puts forth this idea, and it's very much an economic idea that, you know, that if consumers would reject slave-grown sugar, that would bring about the end of slavery. She writes a number of tracts over the period of the 1820s. She is instrumental in getting women involved in the movement in Britain in the 1820s. Women are going out, they're canvassing, they're going from door to door, spreading the free produce or the boycott message. They do some really interesting targeted appeals, so they have different tracts that they use. So they'll have one if they're going to a working class household, that it's sort of a dialogue between the canvasser and the resident of the home, the woman of the home, and they'll have this dialogue with her about slave-grown sugar and the importance of boycotting slave-grown sugar. They have so they develop these different appeals that they take, and they go from home to home. Hayrick was involved in canvassing. Oh, I just went blank. Lester, she was, so they do all of these canvasses, and which is interesting because they're going out. This isn't among their little circle of friends, but they're actually going out to people's homes where they don't know these people, and they're literally going door to door promoting the boycott message. So this is very different than, say, what was going on in the 1790s, when women might gather around the tea table and talk about the boycott and read anti-slavery literature. In this case, these women are actually going out and talking to strangers, which concerns some of the male abolitionists, many of the male abolitionists who, you know, find this very unfeminine behavior on the part of the women who are doing this. But again, it's as successful, if not more successful, than the earlier boycott.
Excellent. So what I think is interesting too about your book, you know, as you're showing us how these different people who might be in some ways are marginalized or are playing an active role in these boycotts. And in chapter 5, you really build on that, I think, by including children. And I think that's really cool. And for our listeners, I hope you'll go out and buy this book. And when you get your copy, look closely at the title, because it's a little little kind of alphabet grammar poetry excerpt right on the front of the cover.
Right.
And I think that's really cool. So I wonder, for example, the M of moral commerce, it says, M is the merchant of the North who buys what slaves produce, so they are stolen, whipped, and worked for his and for our use. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. And this is one of the interesting comparisons between, say, the British and the American movement. So Hayrick really puts forth this very very strongly economic argument against slave labor goods. And that gets picked up and sort of altered by American women in particular, who make the boycott really a matter of the heart. And it's about the emotional response. And so it's really centered in centered in the home, and that women are sort of the key influence in this, because they're the ones that are buying these goods. And so as part of that, women teaching their children anti-slavery, teaching them about abolitionism, teaching them about slavery, but then encouraging children to participate in the boycott as well. So in chapter 4, I focus on Elizabeth Hayrick and the British abolitionist movement in the 1820s. Chapter 5 focuses on Elizabeth Margaret Chandler in the United States in the 1820s. And she's really sort of the counterpart, if you will, a much younger counterpart, but Chandler is the counterpart of Hayrick. But for Chandler, the boycott really is about a matter of the heart and about emotion and really, you know, the boycott beginning in the home and then moving outward from there. And Chandler writes a number of children's poems. It starts with Chandler and these poems that she writes, encouraging children to model abolitionist behavior. So you have poems like The Sugar Plums or, I'm trying to remember, Oppress Me Not to Taste Again is another one. And these were actually later published by Garrison in a collection of poems, Juvenile Poems for the Use of Free American Children of Every Complexion. But the idea is that, you know, you get children to reject this, to reject slave labor goods, and they model this behavior for those around them, the adults. You know, in one of Chandler's poems, the child is given a gift of, I think, sugar plums or some other sort of sweet by the grandmother, and the child says, "Oh no, I can't do that because, you know, that sugar was produced by slaves, and I won't eat it because I don't want to contribute to the oppression of the slaves." So the idea of children modeling this behavior. And then the alphabet book that you referenced, that's a later publication from the 1840s, the Anti-Slavery Alphabet. And a number of the letters in the alphabet actually reference slave labor goods. So again, teaching children about slavery and abolitionism and the importance of rejecting slavery, not only slavery, but rejecting the goods of slave labor. And it really points out, I think the participation of children in this movement really points out how democratic this movement really is, that anybody can participate by simply rejecting. The idea was that anyone can participate by simply rejecting the goods of slave labor. And that children could do this as well. This was something that could be practiced by children as well as adults.
Right. And yeah, I don't know. I always find that particularly fascinating. So I guess maybe because I teach courses where I sometimes look at children's cartoons and literature and things like that. And it's, to me, that's fascinating. And I love the poems.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, so far we've been discussing the proponents of the boycott movement, but some abolitionists thought that this was a bad idea. So I wonder, and you explore this in chapter 6, if you could tell us a bit about why some people linked abolitionism with free produce and thought this was a good idea, but other abolitionists said, no, this is not a good idea.
Well, and Garrison was among those who opposed free produce. He came out initially in support of it. And, you know, you would think with Garrison's emphasis on moral suasion that you know, he would be an automatic supporter of the free produce movement, that is, of the boycott. And he did initially, but he very accurately, you know, I think, recognized just how difficult this prospect, you know, the prospect of the boycott, really how difficult this would be. And he felt that, Garrison in particular felt that, you know, abolitionists get so caught up in this idea of free produce and boycotting everything, and you know, as he says at one point, that they spend so much time trying to find free labor goods and to avoid the products of slave labor that they think that they've done their job, that they've done enough, and it's not enough. You know, there's so much more to be done, and he came to believe that it was really an ineffective tactic. And the more he protested against free produce as an anti-slavery tactic, the more he became a target of, you know, Sarah Pugh and some of the others who supported, many of the others who supported, supported the boycott. You know, they're looking at him and they're saying, but, you know, his example would, if Garrison would embrace the movement, then everybody would embrace the movement. And, you know, they really lamented his lack of support for the movement. But really, it came down to he felt like there were just so many other things, and there was so much opposition to abolitionism that this was just a minor movement and a minor tactic, if you will, in the anti-slavery movement. And it was just too difficult. It was really, really, and he's quite correct in that it's very difficult. It was very difficult to avoid anything produced by slave labor. Those who supported the boycott said, yes, you know, they recognize that difficulty, but they said, we still have to try. It's, you know, it's a matter of ideological consistency. How can we come out in opposition to slavery if we're continuing to benefit from slavery, and even if indirectly?
The thing I wonder, too, just as a kind of side question that just came to mind, I studied Korea. And when Korea was a colony of Japan, they tried to have like a buy Korea movement. And so similar, right? So you would only buy goods made in Japan, and the problem that were made in Korea. And the problem was there was sometimes some corruption where Korean merchants would buy something from Japan and change the label and try and pass off as something Korean. And they had these constant problems. Did that ever come up here?
Oh, absolutely. And it was. You see that a lot with George Taylor, who was really probably at the forefront of the movement from the 1840s through the 1860s in terms of he ran a free produce store in Philadelphia through that period, and you see all of his efforts to try and identify and locate free labor goods, and there are a number of letters between Taylor and he had an agent in the South by the name of Nathan Thomas, and then his brother Thomas Taylor also worked as an agent for him in the South, trying to find free labor goods, free labor cotton in particular. And that was, and it's interesting because in these letters, you know, they identify someone who's growing cotton, and yes, you know, I can, you know, this person and this person and this person can certify that they're not using slave labor. That this is truly free labor cotton. So yes, there was a lot of trouble with corruption and identifying, you know, is this indeed, you know, goods produced by free labor. The other problem that often happened, particularly with sugar, was even if you could be assured that the goods were free labor goods, the quality might not be there. For example, abolitionists tried to substitute maple sugar for cane sugar, and maple sugar is an imperfect substitute for cane sugar. It's got a very distinctive taste. It's too moist for some purposes in cooking, and so even if you could find a free labor substitute, it was an imperfect substitute.
Right. Yeah, I guess some things don't change. So you've talked about the American movement. You talked about the British movement. Each met with varying degrees of success, but it makes sense that people then would try and start an international boycott movement, since you have these, you know, these two, you know, crosses the Atlantic. And you look at this in chapter 7. Why did this not work out though?
Well, you know, some of it came down to some of it's personality. you know, you've got some very strong personalities on both sides of the Atlantic. That's part of the problem. And part of the problem is the growth of the dependence on slave labor goods. You know, Britain is importing an extraordinary amount of slave-grown cotton from the South. It's getting other abolitionists to support the boycott who are not supporting, you know, they're not supporting the boycott at this time. They try several, both British and American abolitionists sort of, you know, they try a number of different, tactics. The American Free Produce Association is organized in the late 1830s with an idea of increasing supply. And yet, you know, they're constantly struggling, to get enough supply. To get enough goods to supply their consumers. Oftentimes, they can't get enough cotton. It's a very minuscule amount of cotton when you compare free labor cotton, you know, you may be talking hundreds of bales versus, you know, compared to the number of bales that are of slave grown cotton that are available, that they just can't begin to supply the world demand for free labor for cotton. And so supply is a big issue here. You have British abolitionists and American abolitionists too, to a lesser extent. You know, they look at India as a possibility. India has its own challenges as well, and there are questions about, you know, the labor conditions there. But supply is a significant issue, but then it's opposition within the movement that, you know, there's an attempt at the World Anti-Slavery Convention in 1840 to pass a free produce resolution that is calling on all abolitionists to use only free labor goods, and it gets watered down, and it's passed as, you know, well, we'll use free labor goods to the extent that it's practical, but they don't ever really define what is meant by practical. And yet, even as the movement sort of faltering on the international stage and in America, the movement is in Ohio and Indiana and some of the more Western states, you know, it's starting to pick up. There's actually some new organizations formed there. And so, you know, like Taylor in Philadelphia is trying to do his best to supply, keep those organizations supplied. Taylor even goes so far as to open up a cotton mill, trying to produce his own cotton, but he can't meet the demand.
Right. So, These practical challenges they face are immense, and I think it's interesting then that Chapter 8, you entitle it "Baling the Atlantic with a Spoon." So my question is, why did you choose that as your subtitle for this chapter?
Well, and it's really in this, because this period is, I'm looking at the period of the 1840s and 1850s, and it really is, at this point, they're having such tremendous challenges with, not that they never, they've always had challenges with supply, but in particular in this period, all of these supply problems, these very pragmatic problems, really become quite acute. And it really is, that's actually coming from Samuel J. May, who compared the free produce movement in the fight for the abolition of slavery. He compares it to baling the Atlantic with a spoon, that it is, in his mind, it's so weak and it's so ineffectual that you might as well be baling the Atlantic Ocean with a spoon. And in a lot of ways, he's quite accurate. Going back to Ed Baptist's book, there's an excellent discussion in there about what he calls first order, second order, and third order effects of slavery. So first order effect would be the crop itself, say the cotton crop. And then the second order effects of slavery are the money, it's the economy that's driven to supply the plantations, to supply cloth for slave, to make slave clothing, the hose, the tools that are used by slaves to produce cotton. But then third order effects are those that come when those individuals who are working and producing those goods that supply the plantations, those individuals then use their salary to go out and purchase goods and services. And so that's the third order effect. And in his discussion, Baptist talks about in 1836, I think it's something like 50% of the American economy is tied in some way to slave labor through these first, second, and third order effects. And that becomes even more, you know, that continues in the 1840s and 1850s as, slaveholders are moving west and developing cotton plantations, as far west as Texas. You see slave-grown cotton in it, and that is becoming such, slave labor goods are such a part of the global economy that it really is, you know, for boycotters to think that they can replace all slave labor goods with free labor goods. It really is like baling the Atlantic with a spoon.
So with that being said, I mean, this is just the challenge that the boycotters faced. To end this, you know, and it's in, at least in the case of American slavery, it's not through the boycott that it ends. It's through the Civil War.
Right.
What then is the significance of the boycott movement in Atlantic history?
Well, I think the significance is, and I really, what I think, where I think it's significant is that it, that the boycotters really forced consumers to confront. They made slavery an inescapable question. Even if you didn't support the boycott, still by making clear this connection between consumers and their purchases and the continuation of slavery, that by making that, you know, making that connection so clear, that they made slavery very much an inescapable question, that we had to, that, you know, that your purchases would, you know, that your purchases, you know, it may seem like they don't have an impact, but they do have an impact. You know, they made this connection between, let me back up and try that again. You know, they made it clear that even in the North, in the so-called free labor North, that consumer purchases there and consumer activities there were still continuing slavery in the South and were responsible for continuing slavery in the South. And so, you know, they really, every purchase, every action that you make in the market becomes a moral transaction. You know, it has moral significance. Do you buy, you know, those goods that are sweetened with maple sugar, or do you buy those goods sweetened with cane sugar? Going back to Sarah Pugh, you know, she wore linen rather than cotton because linen was a free labor good. And so she continued to wear linen even after the Civil War because it was free labor. And she felt that she had to continue that practice. And so I think that's the significance of the movement, is that they really forced consumers, regardless of their stand on slavery, really forced consumers to sort of understand the morality behind their purchases.
Well, excellent. Well, that's something we should certainly always be reflecting on.
Yes.
So, you know, I really enjoyed reading this book. I've enjoyed talking with you. I know we've taken a lot of your time, but I'd like to take a little bit more time to ask our final traditional question. What are you working on now?
Well, I am working on actually a biography of George W. Taylor, the free produce activist that I mentioned. In working on moral commerce, I found at Haverford College the Taylor family papers, which have turned out to be quite extensive. And Taylor was involved in a lot of other things besides free produce, but that's really the only thing that he's known for, is his work with free produce. He was actually involved in temperance. He was involved in Quaker reform movements. He was involved in the peace movement. Quite an interesting individual. His family was quite involved with his free labor business as well. And so that's what I'm working on right now, is a biography of Taylor.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you very much. That sounds like a fascinating project. And thank you very much for your time today, Julie.
Thank you.
This has been the Christian Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm Dr. Franklin Rausch of Lander University, the host of the channel. I want to thank you for listening to this interview, and I hope you'll come back and listen to another one soon.